guys have worked in teams of more than one. But that wasn't it, not really. My instincts were chattering unhelpfully, conclusions without evidence. He caught my not-quite-lie.
The group that took Adam were human, yes? Fae and human do not work well together. Yet you are sure she is involved.
I glanced at him. His eyes were dark again, and I was relieved.
Mercedes, why do you think she is part of the kidnapping plot and not of some other thing? Adam is Alpha, and you are his mate. That makes you targets for all sorts of people.
It struck me that Azeel was perfectly okay with the fact that there might be two separate groups out to kill us. I think, I said, that adding another... And remember that he already thought there was more than one gun aimed at my pack, even if they were all mostly working together. Adding yet another enemy who wants to kidnap or kill me to this soup pushes my belief in the ultimate fairness of the universe too far to one side. I just wish I knew how she knew we were coming here. I looked up at the back windows of Sylvia's apartment. She was a smart woman who worked at a police station. Her apartment was on the third floor. There was nothing to hint at a problem within. No bodies flying through the air, no broken glass, no little pink-clad Sandoval girl screaming as she ran from scary people with guns. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe my dead assailant had been on her own. Add to that, I continued almost absently because my instincts were screaming at me. Azeel's eyes were still dark, so I risked breaking into a jog. I haven't ticked off any of the Fae lately. It's not the vampires in a separate attack. If Marsilia had decided to put me out of my misery today, she would have succeeded. I wish I knew how our dead Fae knew to come here. Either they overheard Tad and me talking, or they somehow knew to look here. My voice trailed off, because I realized how stupid I'd been. Someone who didn't know the soap opera of my life from close up might not realize that Gabriel's mother and he were estranged. Sylvia's apartment would be the last place I'd have looked for the kids. But someone from the outside, someone who only knew that Gabriel had gone missing with Ben and Jesse and me, someone like that might very well check out his nearest relatives. I'd overestimated our enemies, and they'd found Jesse. That's what my instincts had been telling me.
Mercy?
Asked Azeel, who had sped up to keep pace with me. His beautiful accent made him sound like someone's lover instead of a man who had killed a woman with as little thought as I gave to opening a jar of mayonnaise. Maybe less thought. Not that he scared me anymore. Not now, when I was pretty sure we were going to need him soon. The back wall of Sylvia's apartment blew out, spitting stucco, plaster, glass, insulation, and a man's body down on the sidewalk below. Some of the debris must have bounced because nearby car alarms went off. The body rolled when it hit the ground, got up, ran back at the apartment building, and did a Jackie Chan up the side. I was really happy to see him moving because I'd recognized him on the way down. Tad! I hadn't intended to yell or run, but I was doing both. Azeel paced me, but we split up as we reached the apartment building. He went in the same way Tad had, and I, not blessed with supernatural strength, had to run up the stairs instead. I ran up those steps as fast as I've ever run. The door opened, and Jesse and Gabriel spilled onto the stairs with various Sandovals clinging, pushing, and sobbing. I counted and came up one short. No Sylvia, even as I slid over the guardrail to stand on the outside of the bars on the edge of the stairs to let the youngsters by. "Your mom?" I said as they passed. "At work," Gabriel said. I tossed him the keys to Marsilia's car. "Take the car. It's over by the garbage bins, three buildings that way." I pointed appropriately. "Get to Kyle's house, but don't speed. You have a body in the trunk and no child car seats."
"Body?" said the oldest of Gabriel's sisters.
If I weren't clinging to the stairway while there was a lot of noise coming from above where someone who might as well have been my little brother had gotten tossed through a wall just a few seconds ago, I could have remembered her name. Right now, I could barely remember my own. They were tough, though, Sandoval kids. They'd be okay with a body in the trunk of the car. "Bad guy," I said, "tried to kill me and got taken out by my backup."
"Cool,"
said one of the littler ones, Sissy. They hadn't paused in their downward trek, and once on solid ground, Gabriel rearranged everyone so the littles were carried. Jess took advantage of the lull to mouth, "Dad?" at me. "He's alive," I told her, "but that's all I know. Get out of here." and then I rolled back over the railing and up the last set of stairs and headed into the apartment, only then remembering that I'd left my gun in Marsilia's car. I stripped out of my clothes and let my coyote out. In the distance, I could hear sirens. The police department wasn't too far from here, and there was no way anyone could have ignored the noise coming from Sylvia's apartment. As human, I stood no chance against something that could throw Tad through a wall. As a coyote, I was definitely outmatched, but I could be distracting, and I was just that much faster on four legs than on two. Fast enough to outrun most werewolves, anyway. I skulked into the living room, the only room I'd been in before. On top of the scent of the Sandoval family, I could smell werewolf, Tad, and something fey. The fey smell mostly like the old philosopher's division of the world to me. Earth, air, fire, water, with the addition of green growing things. Ariana smelled like forest, and so did this fey. The noise was coming from a room farther into the apartment. Someone screamed, and I couldn't tell who it was. I set caution aside and bolted down the narrow hallway and into the master bedroom at the end. The dead woman's partner was nightmare hideous. His head was misshapen and too large for his body. One large eye, emerald green and liquid, stared off to the side, while the other was only half as large and solid black. Two odd lumps that looked like nascent antlers emerged from his temples. His nose was two slits, above a mouth too large for his face, and filled with uneven, spade-shaped yellow teeth. A black tongue flicked out and across his nose slits as he fought. For all his horribleness, he wasn't more than 4 feet tall. His body was slender, almost delicate-looking, with wrists smaller than mine, in human shape. His outsized, four-fingered hands gripped a sword made of some sort of black metal that was nearly as tall as he. Azeel had a baseball bat and was using it like a katana. Turn and turn and never let the bastard get a good hard strike on your weapon. The Japanese had had lousy steel and had learned to compensate. Tad had a pair of kitchen knives and was keeping the fey from getting into a good rhythm with them. Unhappily, it was interfering with Azeel, too. The fey fought well, like someone who had learned the sword when it was the weapon of choice. Not all fey were long-lived. Some had lives comparable to insects, a few seasons, then gone. Most of those, he had told me once when he was a little drunk, were gone in truth, their more fragile lives incapable of dealing with the steel and concrete that was conquering the earth. Others lived nearly human-long, 20 years for some, 150 for others. Originally, only a small percentage of fey were nearly immortal. The rise of humans and technology had selected for those tougher fey, and they now accounted for a far higher percentage of the fey than they ever had before. A human lifetime was long enough to become an expert swordsman. My own karate sensei was accounted quite good in various weapon forms, including the sword. But Azeel was a famous swordsman with centuries of practice, and this fey was more than holding his own. He was old. Tad wasn't doing badly. His father had taught him, he told me once. If Tad had had something bigger than kitchen knives, if he and Azeel had fought together before, they could have worked together. As it was, they had difficulty staying out of each other's way. I slunk down low and, keeping to the outside edge of the room, slowly moved closer to the fight. I slid under the bed. Under my bed, dust bunnies, underwear, and a random shoe or two were common residents. But Sylvia was more organized than I. And all she had under her bed was one of those thin plastic containers full of wrapping paper. I crawled from the head to the foot of the bed and, with my nose under the bedspread, watched for a chance to be of use. The fey, leaping back to avoid Azeel's baseball bat, hit Sylvia's desk and rolled over it, sending monitor and keyboard crashing off the top, along with a small clay jar filled with writing implements. Several neat stacks of rubber-banded papers escaped the hit. The fey hissed and damn near levitated off the desk like a cat thrown in a swimming pool and all but crashed into Azeel to get away. In the Tri-Cities, whose population has largely been employed by the government in one way or another for more than half a century, there is an abundance of those old, clunky, steel desks straight out of the 1950s. I've seen them at rummage sales and every other kind of sale, and once, memorably, a good friend went to a government sale and thought she was bidding on a pallet with two desks and a dozen broken chairs, but ended up with a row of pallets, nearly 50 desks, 315 broken office chairs, a non-functional electric pencil sharpener, and four boxes of pink erasers. My office chair at the garage was actually four of those chairs, all Frankensteined into one that worked. These industrial-strength desks were painted various shades of gray and institutional green or yellow. Sylvia's desk was of the yellow variety, and like all of them, made of steel. Which meant that unlike the dead woman, and despite the big sword he was waving around so skillfully, this fae could not bear the touch of cold iron or steel. Tad dropped his knives and lunged, but Azeel had just pushed the fae directly in front of me, so I didn't wait to see why. I sprang out from my hiding place and buried my teeth in the fae's left calf. I don't have jaws like a bulldog, but I locked my jaws as best I could anyway. Azeel swore at me in Spanish. I knew it was me because he ended it with Mercedes. I knew it was swearing because, even in lyrical, if to me mostly unfathomable Spanish, swearing sounds like swearing. Azeel also struck the sword on an upswing to keep the fae from hitting me with the pommel. The sword, edge against the wood of Azeel's weapon, sliced the bat in two, leaving Azeel with 18 inches of wood to fight the fae's magicked blade. It hadn't felt any different to my senses than any other sword until the edge touched wood, and then it tasted like Z's magic. The fae laughed as my weight caused him to stumble. He said something in Welsh that in less dire circumstances I might have been able to translate or at least guess at. He aimed the sharp end of his sword toward me as he caught his balance.
"Let go!" yelled Tad,
and the steel desk hit the fae with a boom that would have done credit to a cannon. Papers, bills, bits and pieces of computer parts, and office detritus flew out the previously made hole in the wall, along with the fae and me. Landing jolted me enough that I lost hold of his calf, only then realizing that Tad's let go had been aimed at me. The desk landed right next to my head before rolling onto the fae, leaving me half-stunned on the grass. The fae shrieked, a pain-filled, rage-filled sound that hit my ears like a blow. If I'd heard it from a mile away, I'd have known it didn't come from a human throat. I smelled burning flesh, and he lifted the desk off and tossed it into the road where it bounced once and cartwheeled into a battered truck. He started to reach past me for his sword, which lay a dozen feet from us where it had fallen, but someone else got there first. The fae hesitated for a bare moment, his eyes on the sword, but the sound of sirens up close and personal, or maybe it was the face of the man holding his sword, made him turn on his heels and run. Tad called insults from the open hole in the wall of Sylvia's bedroom. The man who stood over me tossed the fae sword aside and dropped down to sit beside me. Gentle hands moved over me, but I couldn't focus, couldn't breathe, hoped so hard that it took longer to regain my ability to pump air into my lungs. As soon as I did, I shifted back to human and squirmed into his lap.
"Adam,"
I said, clutching him like a ninny while something tight in the middle of my chest softened. Tears slid down my cheeks. It would have been humiliating if he hadn't been clutching me back just as hard. I wiped my eyes and pulled away to look at him. He was a little the worse for wear, his beard at the scratchy stage, and his eyes were... it had been bad. However he'd escaped, it had cost him. He kissed me. And it was a hard, possessive kiss. He pulled back and said,
"So I went hunting you and got here just in time to see you flying out of a hole in the third story of an apartment attached to a man's leg."
There were burns on his lips, and I reached up to touch them. "Silver," I said. It was important, because I didn't want to hurt Adam, but I lost track of what I was saying.
"Hey, you two lovebirds," said Tad dryly. "I couldn't help but notice that Mercy is buck naked, and we have police arriving, so I fetched her clothes."
Adam looked up and smiled at Tad, but he spoke to me.
"Better get dressed, Mercy. Tad's right."
I bounced out of his lap and grabbed the clothes from Tad and pulled them on with more speed than grace. Everything hurt, and I looked at Adam, who was rising to his feet. Nothing hurt at all. Tad strove over to the blade on the grass and looked at it assessingly.
Come here, then, he told it, and held his hand up. The sword flew into his grip, then disappeared. He closed his hand over a small bit of metal and shoved it into his pocket.
That will make it a little hard to explain the bat it cut into two, but it's too dangerous to allow it to get put into police custody, he told me. Dangerous for the police.
My head felt fuzzy, but then I'd just been tossed out of a third-story window and discovered Adam was safe, and here, and that meant I didn't have to be in charge anymore. With Adam here, I had no worries left at all, none. Something happened, some magic that smelled like Faye had just been waiting for that moment, but I was too happy to worry about that either. I tied the drawstring at my waist and asked Tad, "Your father made that sword, didn't he? Out of something that isn't iron or steel, so that the Fae could use it." Tad nodded, looking at me closely.
"I think there were five of these swords, each a little bit different from the other. Dad has one. All of them are bad news. If someone's not using them to slaughter a crowd of people, then some damned Grey Lord is blathering about how such a Fae treasure needs to be protected. The Grey Lords are amassing Fae artifacts like dragons amassing gold. And if this is too dangerous for the police, it's way too dangerous to be putting into the hands of the Grey Lords. I'll give this one to my dad, and he can worry about dealing with it."
He looked at me carefully and tilted his head.
"Touch your nose, Mercy."
I put my hand on my nose, but it felt like my nose. If there was some smudge or something, I couldn't tell. He looked at Adam and started to say something, but a police car stopped next to the desk in the road, lights flashing, but siren thankfully silent. As if it was the signal everyone was waiting for, people started boiling out of their apartments. Two more police cars followed, and the middle one disgorged Sylvia. Tony got out of the driver's seat and followed her.
"Gabriel and the kids are okay," I yelled over the sounds of people talking and exclaiming over the damaged building. "I sent them to Kyle's."
Sylvia stopped and closed her eyes, crossed herself sincerely, if briefly. She strode over to us, Tony in her wake. She looked up at the hole in the wall of her apartment.
"Tad stopped them," I told her, "and Gabriel made sure all the kids got out safely."
"Who did this?" asked Tony carefully. He was looking at the hole in the wall, too.
Tad made a noise, and Adam moved behind me and wrapped his arms around my shoulders. I leaned my chin on his forearms, content in his hold.
"They were professionals, mercenaries."
There had been no fire in the woman who attacked me, no anger. No sorrow. This had been a job, and nothing more.
"I know who this one was," said Tad unexpectedly. "Not that it'll help us any. Hey, Tony, long time no see." "Good to see you, Chico," Tony told him. "What happened?" "Mercy Stowe, Jesse, and Gabriel. You know Gabriel, right?"
Tony looked at Sylvia and nodded.
"I introduced Gabriel to Mercy in the first place."
"Don't think I haven't forgotten that," said Sylvia,
and he winced a little. Looked at me and winced again. Sylvia gave me a look that would have sent vampires running for cover. She was rather pointedly ignoring Adam.
"You are sure that the children are safe?"
"I sent them to Kyle's house," I told her.
But she didn't know Kyle.
"He's a boyfriend of one of the wolves, a lawyer. He's got security people guarding his house, so the kids will be safe there."
"I'm sorry, Sylvia. If I had thought that they would know to look here, I never would have brought Jesse."
"You also sent this one," she tipped her head toward Tad, "though he looked like a boy no older than Gabriel."
"I'm tough," Tad said soulfully, looking more puppy-like and not very tough at all. I couldn't tell what Sylvia was thinking, but she bent down and started collecting the paper that littered the ground.
"Right," said Tad breezily to Tony. "So Mercy left Jesse and Gabriel with Sylvia, thinking they would be safe here from whoever was trying to grab them. But she was worried about them and asked me to keep an eye out."
I saw comprehension dawn on Tony's face.
"You're Z's son," he said. "I keep forgetting that makes you half Fae."
It was easy to forget. Tad looked human, just like the purebloods do most of the time. I never have known whether Tad's appearance is a glamour like the one his father wears, or if he really does just look human. Half Fae, I am told, can go either way. And some of the half-fae who don't look human also don't have enough magic to hide what they are. A lot of those don't make it to adulthood. The fae are a very, very practical race as a whole. Tad nodded at Tony. Mercy knew I have enough oomph to cause a big ruckus if someone came calling, and someone did.
He looked up at the apartment ruefully.
If we can't catch the bastards who did this, I suppose I'll have to pay to get it fixed.
Not your debt, said Adam.
His voice was different, darker and harsher than usual, but he was so warm against my back.
We will take care of the expense of fixing your apartment, Sylvia.
I waited for her to explode, and I couldn't blame her. No one looking at the wall that lay mostly on the postage stamp lawn next to the apartment would think that her children had been safe. It was my fault, I told her. These guys knew the identities of all the pack members, even the ones they shouldn't have. I assumed that they would also know that you and Gabriel hadn't been talking, but I think they just hunted down Gabriel's nearest relative. Sylvia stood up, tapped a handful of bills she'd gathered on her leg, and looked at the hole in her apartment. Then she looked at me.
No, she said slowly. It isn't your fault. It is the fault of the people who came into my home intending to harm innocents.
You are right, Adam told her, but then added with alpha firmness,
but the pack will still pay for the damages. They were hunting my daughter.
She frowned at him, but couldn't look at his face for too long.
All right, she said, her voice a little softer than it had been.
She looked at Tad.
You are a good young man, and it seems just as tough as you told me you were. Thank you for the care you took of my children.
Hey, Sylvia, a young man wearing a WSU shirt called out. You need some help? Me and Tom can get your desk back up to your apartment, and maybe some of these looky-loos can pick up the mess.
He tugged the braid of a cute girl a few years his junior who was standing next to him.
Stop it, she said, batting his hand away. Yes, sure, Miss Sandoval, we can do cleanup.
An anxious, middle-aged woman with a clipboard ran out to join the festivities. I'm Sally Osterberg, she said to one of the officers who was taking down notes. I'm the apartment manager. Can you tell me what happened?
We're just getting to that, Sally, said Sylvia, still unnaturally calm.
Maybe it was that she had all that training for working dispatch, or maybe it was just being a single parent to a herd of kids whose ages span the school system.
Do you prefer to do the repairs yourself and submit a bill, or would you rather we hire contractors to fix it? Asked Adam.
Sally turned to him and paused before her face lit up.
Adam Hauptman? You are Adam Hauptman? Oh my goodness, I thought, I saw in the news that you had been kidnapped by some kind of paramilitary group. Did you have to fight your way out? Are they?
She stopped, and not because she'd run out of words. I tipped my head so that I could see Adam smile as he told her,
I am. I did. And this seems to be connected to whoever has it in for my pack and me.
This is so exciting, she said. Wait until I tell my sister we had a werewolf crash through a wall, and not just any werewolf either.
She caught herself and blushed bright red.
I sound like a dork.
No, Adam said, not bothering to correct her misapprehension about who had done most of the destruction. You don't. You sound like anyone would when caught up in Twilight Zone events. Can you get someone to board that hole up so Ms. Sandoval's possessions don't suffer from the weather?
Oh, yes, she promised, right away.
Thank you.
He gave her another smile, which she returned until her eyes met mine. She cleared her throat.
I'll just go do that.
Tony looked at her trotting off, then looked at Adam.
Next time we have a domestic disturbance, I'm taking you with me.
Adam smiled, and I could see how tired he was.
That only works sometimes. On violent men, I often have the opposite effect. Unless you want bodies on the ground, you'll want to lead me home.
So, said an officer standing beside Tony, is there someone here who wants to tell us what happened? Without bodies or injured, we're not in emergency status, but the lieutenant does like us to get enough for an accurate report.
I opened my mouth, but Tad gave me another of those sharp looks he'd been sending me. He turned to face the policeman who'd asked, and at the same time put his body between me and the officer as his best aw shucks smile lit his face.
I'd spent most of the last day sitting on that fence.
He nodded toward the 8-foot concrete block fence that encircled the apartment complex. Then he saw the cop's face.
I know, right? You're wondering why I pulled guard duty when I looked like the before picture on a gym advertisement. My dad is Fay, though, and I'm stronger than I look. Anyway, Jesse was making...
Jesse?
Adam's daughter, the one we were trying to keep safe from the bad guys, said Tad, moving behind the officer so he could see his notes. She spells it J-E-S-S-E, and I'm Tad, like Tadpole, short for Thaddeus, but don't go there. And my last name is Adalbert Smiter. He spelled that for him, too. Twice. The officer turned to force Tad to give him some space, but Tad just followed him around. Thank you, the officer said firmly. What happened to the wall? He looked at me, but Tad answered that, too. I was eating Jesse's brownies when someone rang the doorbell. I sent Jesse, Gabriel, and the kids into one of the bedrooms and went to answer the door. So you let him in? Do I look like I'm five? Asked Tad indignantly. No, I asked who it was, and he said he was UPS and had a package for us. I told him to leave it on the porch because I was naked, just out of the shower. I thought you were eating brownies, said the officer, who seemed to have resigned himself to having Tad hanging over his shoulder. I was, Tad shook his head. I lied to the guy. I was there to keep the kids safe, and no way was I opening the door to some stranger. There are things out there who can take it for an invitation, and you don't invite evil into your home. No, said the officer faintly. I can see that you wouldn't. Tony rubbed his mouth to hide a smile. Tony had seen Tad in full-blown look-at-me mode before. It wasn't that Tad was lying to the police officer, but like a good stage magician, he'd keep the police looking where he wanted them to look. I didn't know what Tad was trying to cover up, but with Adam here and safe, I didn't really care.
I thought you fake couldn't lie, said one of the kids who was supposed to be cleaning Sylvia's stuff off the ground.
Tad nodded at him. Yeah, that's only the true Fae and some of the halfies. All that kind of stuff doesn't apply to me, 'cause I lie, and he spread his arms to invite everyone to admire. I'm still here.
Behind me, Adam laughed quietly.
Anyway, continued Tad, now talking to the crowd instead of the police. The supposed UPS guy, he said he needed a signature. I told him to leave a form and we'd pick the package up at the UPS office. And that's when he unlocked the door with some kind of pick lock or magic. I wasn't paying attention because he tried to hit me with a stun gun. When that didn't work, he drew a freaking sword and tried to take off my head.
A sword? Said the officer, who was starting to look as though he was having trouble keeping up.
Tad nodded. I know, right? Weirded me out, too. I guess he was pretty old, 'cause he knew what he was doing with that thing. I took 2 years of Aikido at school, and he made a monkey out of me.
I wondered if anyone would notice that although Tad was pretty banged up, there were no sword cuts.
I drew him back farther into the apartment to give the kids a chance to escape. Sometime in there, he tossed me through the wall.
All the people who were cleaning up the mess near him and the policemen and policewoman who were listening to his story looked at Tad because he didn't look like he'd been tossed through a wall. Tad wasn't good-looking. His ears were too big and they stuck out, and his nose was flattened as if he'd gone 3 rounds with George Foreman. But when he wanted people to watch him, they did. It wasn't magic. It was force of personality.
"Hafe," he told them again. "Sometimes it helps."
He looked up at the hole, too, and shook his head and winced.
Doesn't mean it didn't hurt. I ran back up and kept him occupied while the kids escaped. I tossed the desk at him, knocked him out the same hole he'd knocked me through, and by then you guys were pretty close. He picked himself up and ran.
Apparently we weren't going to talk about Azeel. I glanced around, but didn't see Bran's wolf anywhere. Maybe Azeel was responsible for Tad's look at me, not at what I'm hiding performance.
Adam, what can you tell me about your kidnapping?
Tony wasn't as caught up in Tad's performance as the other cops were. Adam gave him a tired smile.
I'm going to get some rest. I'll have my lawyer get in touch with you, and I'll give you a full statement tomorrow, okay?
Tony gave him a reluctant nod.
Fine. Get in touch before 10 tomorrow, or I'll give you a call. Mercy, your turn.
I thought about the body in the back of Marsilia's car and tried to decide where to start.
She didn't see much, Tad said,
and this time I could feel his magic push past me, focusing Tony's attention on him.
How about she takes Adam home and they both talk to you tomorrow? I know who this guy was because he's a Spriggand. That's a kind of fae and fairly rare, thankfully, because they are nasty, bitter mischief makers one and all. This one is a pureblood, and that makes him a renegade because he's not holed up in the reservations with the rest of the Fae. There's only one renegade Spriggand. He goes by the name of Sliver, and usually hangs out with a half-Fae woman called Spice. They hire out as muscle or assassins. I didn't see any woman, but she might have been keeping watch.
Spice must be the dead woman in the trunk of Marsilia's car. It would have been a good time for me to tell the police about her. Her death was self-defense. If I told them right now, it would look better than if they found out about it later. But I was content just resting against Adam, and couldn't find the impetus to say anything.
Tony frowned at Tad. And why do you know the names of assassins for hire?
Tad's brilliant facade soured.
Because even though they don't care a fig for the half-bloods, the pure-blooded Fae send us lists of Fae who did not answer the Grey Lord's call. We, the rejected, are to watch out for these Fae and turn in any pure-bloods we see.
Tony nodded slowly.
I see. And if you don't turn them in?
Tad's smile left entirely, and he looked very adult.
Nothing good. The Grey Lords don't have much use for half-bloods.
Tony blinked a couple of times and bit back whatever homily had come to him. Finally, he looked around at the destruction that was getting cleaned up. It was a crime scene, so probably no one should be cleaning yet, but it was also Sylvia's private papers flying in the wind.
No bodies on the ground, said the officer Tad had cornered. No one bleeding, no lawsuit because Mr. Hauptmann is paying the damages, though we'll need to do a report just in case. We can let them clean up, Tony.
He looked at Adam.
Mr. Hauptmann is coming in tomorrow to make a statement about his kidnapping. That works for me. Tony?
Tony frowned at me, and Tad's magic lit up again. Finally, Tony said,
Okay.
He looked at Sylvia, and his face softened.
Why don't you give your keys to one of your neighbors so they can lock up after they're done cleaning the mess? I'll take you to Kyle's house so you can look in on the kids.
Chapter 8 Adam. Adam kept his mouth shut and left his arms wrapped around Mercy so that he was anchored and didn't snarl at the nice policeman. He kept his eyes off her face, because he was having a hard enough time with all the noise and people as it was. The bruise that covered half her face would not help. His instincts kept shouting that something was wrong, and had ever since he'd seen the desk land, and he couldn't tell if it had missed her. He'd stopped breathing. The thought of his world without Mercy in it. Well, that didn't help him calm down either. He had the feeling that enemies were watching, that no one was safe. It was just the after-effects of battle, dealing with his kidnappers last night and interrupting Mercy's fight this morning. That on-edge feeling had been familiar even before he was a werewolf. Adam politely refused to answer any of Tony's casual questions as they waited for Sylvia to converse with her neighbors. The policeman finally gave up prying. He was a good cop, Tony, and knew that there were things they were hiding. But Adam had scrubbed in the shower of the unfinished winery while they were waiting for Elisaveta to show up. He knew that the only stains left of his killing spree were invisible ones, and he knew how to hide those, even from a good cop's instincts. Tony picked up a fluttering paper that had attacked his shoe and looked at it. A bill from the power company, Adam saw, with a lot of red on it. Tony clenched it in his hand. It was no secret that Tony loved Sylvia, or that she had put him off firmly. But, Jesse had told Adam, that had been a couple of years ago when Sylvia's husband had been dead only a year. Tony had respected her wishes and backed off then, which was the right thing to do. But, maintained Jesse, someone should kick Tony and make him try again. Or else, judging by the expression on Tony's face while he shoved the crumpled bill into his pocket, maybe a Fae should destroy her home, threaten her children, and leave her unpaid bills floating in the wind. Sylvia was tough, smart, and could survive on her own. She didn't need a handsome prince to ride up and rescue her. But that didn't mean such a man might not want to protect her from everything he could, anyway. Adam tipped his head down to see if Mercy had noticed Tony's epiphany, but as soon as she realized he was looking at her, she turned her attention to him and smiled. Her lips were outlined in black that faded to gray. If it had been lipstick, it would have been an interesting effect with her coloring. But he knew from the way the silver had burned his skin when he'd kissed her, that it wasn't some new color of lipstick. He was also sure that the silver impregnating her lips had something to do with the way she'd taken it from him through their mate bond. He just hoped to hell that she hadn't been harmed any other way from that. It might mean they weren't going to be able to kiss without giving him blisters for the rest of their lives, but he could deal, as long as that was the worst it had done. There were a lot of things to worry about tomorrow. Today, he was good. He waited until Sylvia was secured in Tony's car. Then, when he was satisfied the people he felt responsible for were safe, it was time to leave. He kissed Mercy's temple and said, "Wait here." Then he headed off at a jog to find his people. He found both identical Toyota Corollas, the one he'd arrived in and the other manned by Mercy's surveillance team, parked near the dumpster. He had the man who'd driven with him hand over the keys and ride back with the other two. By the simple expedient of combining them, he gained a car to take Mercy back to Kyle's. He opened the door, but realized as he bent to slide in that the pair of shoes on the ground next to his car were Mercy's, as was a sock just under the dumpster. He smelled Mercy, death, Faye, and a strange werewolf. It was the last scent that made him growl. He'd forgotten that Mercy had gone off with a werewolf Bran had sent to help, a werewolf who was making himself conspicuously absent. It appeared that more had happened than just the part of the fight he'd seen. He gathered up sock and shoes and drove the car back to where he'd left Mercy. She waited for him just where he'd told her to, and waved to him cheerfully as he drove up. Beside her, looking at the ground, stood Z's son. His face, now that there was no one to perform for, looked worried. As Adam pulled up, Tad turned to him and said, "Is it okay if I come along?" He looked at Mercy and frowned a little. Adam was unhappy about all those bruises, too. "Before all this happened, I was going to go to Kyle's with Mercy and the kids." "Fine," agreed Adam. If Tad hadn't asked, Adam would have insisted. He wasn't leaving any of his people vulnerable, and Tad belonged to Mercy and thus to Adam. Adam glanced at Mercy and said, "I'll drive." He knew that he looked nearly as rough as he felt. He'd seen himself in the bathroom mirror after his shower, and Mercy was better at reading his face than most people. Even the half-beard he wore wouldn't protect him from her scrutiny. He waited for Mercy's response. He enjoyed their arguments, because very few people argued with him at all. Mercy would argue until she won, he convinced her he was right, or it was clear that she was not going to win no matter how right she felt she was. If she was cranky enough about it, she'd get him back. That damned Junker Rabbit was still cocked up on one wheel where he could see it out their bedroom window. He kind of liked it. Not the leprous rabbit, the rabbit made him crazy, but that she cared enough to make the effort. This was a battle he wouldn't lose, though he probably shouldn't drive. His concentration was as shot as his temper. Nothing like lack of sleep and battle fatigue to give him fuel for a really nasty case of road rage. Even so, there was no way that he could relinquish enough control to let anyone else take the wheel, not even Mercy, who was a good driver. Instead of arguing, Mercy just smiled and got into the passenger seat without a word. Inexplicably, that sent his temper flaring worse than if she'd argued. He bit his tongue, because he'd look like an idiot if he yelled at her for not arguing with him. Tad hopped into the back and fastened his seatbelt. As Adam drove out of the parking lot, Tad said, "We should pick up the other werewolf over by the high school. Just turn down 10th.
"Why did he run off?" Adam asked, then looked at Mercy.
"He was worried that his presence would just complicate things."
In the rearview mirror, Adam noticed that Ted was tapping his fingers and watching Mercy as if he was worried about her.
"Who died over by the dumpsters?" Adam asked.
"The other half of the Fae team who tried to take Jesse," Mercy said, sounding as if she were talking about something mundane, like grocery shopping. "She jumped me when we parked, and Azeel killed her. By the time it occurred to me that it would be smart to tell the police about her, the kids had already taken off in the car with the body." Adam damn near stopped the car. On any other day, he'd have been upset about a body in the trunk of the kid's car, but that was before he'd heard Azeel's name.
"Bran sent the Moor?"
"Azeel," Mercy agreed, so he knew he hadn't misheard. "He said Charles sent him, but he was talking in front of Agent Armstrong of Cantrip." Armstrong must have been the Fed who was at Kyle's house, the one who tried to get him to wait when Adam had hustled out to find Mercy. Mercy was right. Bran had sent the Moor to take care of Mercy and Jesse. The Moor, who was so crazy his own son had sent him to Bran to be put down, except that Bran, for his own reasons, had decided not to do it. Azeel. Maybe he had recovered from being crazy.
"He kept that bastard from wiping the floor with me," said Tad. "I was overmatched, and that's an understatement. I might have been able to slow the Spriggan down long enough for Jesse and Gabriel to get the kids away, but it would have been a close thing, and I would have had to pull out my big guns to do it."
He looked out the window and continued blackly,
"My control of the big guns isn't what it should be, so I'm glad Azeel showed up."
College had changed Tad. It was supposed to, Adam knew. But looking at Tad for a moment longer than was really safe while he was driving, Adam was afraid that he'd gained the sort of knowledge that a chick learned from being pushed off a cliff rather than the low branch of a tree, and had taken damage from the fall. Adam had grown up that way, too. The Moor was waiting for them, leaning on a light post and looking bored. Adam had never actually met Azeel, but he looked Moorish, wolfish, and dangerous. Who else could he be? He didn't have a mark on him from the fight, though it would be hard to see a bruise on his skin from a distance. People were looking at him as they drove past in their cars, mostly, Adam thought, because Azeel was wearing nothing more than a summer weight shirt. It took a more experienced eye than most people had to see exactly what Azeel was. As he pulled the Corolla over to the curb, Adam met Azeel's eyes briefly, and the old wolf gave Adam a commiserating smile, which Adam found himself returning. This trip was going to be rough. Probably worse for Adam, who was still wound up tight with the aftermath of this morning's killing. But if half the stories Adam had heard were right, Azeel was wobbling precariously between human and beast, so it wouldn't be easy for him to be cooped up in the car with an unfamiliar dominant wolf either. Azeel opened the door behind Mercy and slid into the back seat. As soon as the door shut, the urge to tear out the strange wolf's throat tightened Adam's hands on the wheel. He should not be driving, feeling like this. But without the task of getting to Kyle's in one piece to focus on, he was certain to do something regrettable. "Adam," said Tad, clearing his throat because he doubtless could read the uncomfortable atmosphere in the car,
"we need to go to my dad's house before we go anywhere else."
"Why?"
It was almost a growl rather than a real word. Adam needed to keep his time in the car with the other wolf to a minimum, and that didn't include a side trip. Azeel's presence behind him was an itch between his shoulder blades.
"Because that damned sword isn't the only Fey artifact that Sliver and Spice ran around with, and Mercy is acting strange."
"Yes," howled the beast that lived in his heart. "There is something wrong with Mercy, I've been trying to tell you. But you thought it was just from the fighting. It isn't. This is like what happened to her before when we couldn't protect her."
Adam looked at Mercy, who looked back at him with big eyes and a half smile on her face. "I'm fine," she said, which, if it had been true, she would never have said, not in that tone of voice. She'd have been arguing with Tad or making smart-ass quips about strange people.
"Rub your nose," Tad told her.
She rubbed her nose.
"Patch your knee."
She did that as well.
"Cough twice."
She covered her mouth and coughed.
"Have you ever seen Mercy take three orders in a row without arguing?"
Not being psychic and able to hear Adam's inner beast, Tad thought he had to convince Adam.
"Not even when Bran is the one giving the orders."
Adam put his foot down on the gas. If the tension in the car had been strong before, it was nothing to the current conditions, and it had nothing to do with the Moor. Adam wanted to kill something, anything, to make Mercy all right. Under his hands, the wheel of the car groaned, and he loosened his fingers and fought not to lose control. The other werewolf was doing his best to make this easy, keeping quiet and keeping his gaze focused out his window so Adam couldn't meet his eyes. Adam appreciated it, and tried to reciprocate as well as he could when anger was a tide that threatened to blind him.
"What did they use, and how do we fix her?"
He spoke between gritted teeth, trying to keep his human form and stay between the white lines on the road. His hands tightened again, and there was a pop as something gave way in the steering wheel of the little car. When it didn't seem to affect his ability to turn, Adam ignored it. I don't know how to fix her, said Tad, but my dad will. He can't use phones anymore. Mercy called him yesterday, and the powers that be took away his phone privileges. I have a way to reach him at home.
Okay. Z was good.
Adam sucked in a deep breath and tried to make his wolf realize that changing right now was a genuinely bad idea.
What was it that got her?
He knew squat about fey magic, but couldn't help but ask. Maybe it would be something that wore off.
An artifact. A set of bone wrist cuffs, Tad said. It's supposed to make prisoners easy to control. Before Azeel killed her, did Spice put a set of cuffs on you, Mercy?
Just one, Mercy said in a chipper voice. I changed a coyote and stepped out of it. Azeel threw the cuffs into the trunk with the body.
If this is true, Azeel said, why didn't it show up until after the battle was over? She wasn't being compliant when she threw herself at the Fae in the apartment.
I don't know, answered Tad. Maybe because she only wore one of the cuffs. Maybe because she only had it on for a short time. But you see it, don't you, Adam? It took me a while to be sure.
Yes.
His beast had noticed immediately and become frantic, but Adam hadn't wanted to see anything wrong. Z's house was less than a mile from Kennewick High School, a small Victorian nestled in a small cluster of houses that dated from the time that Kennewick was a tiny transportation hub connecting railroad and river traffic. The house needed paint and a little work on the porch. The yard was tiny, as was common in the days when the use of horses meant that the distance between places mattered more. House and yard were surrounded by a wrought iron fence that was suitably elaborate for an iron-kissed fae's home. Adam put his hand on Mercy's shoulder and brought up the rear of the procession to the house. Even through the sweatshirt she wore, he felt the silver that coursed in her blood. Tad didn't unlock the door when he turned the fancy brass knob, but Adam had the feeling that he'd unlocked it in some other way. Mercy would have known, because Mercy could sense magic a lot better than Adam could. Z's house was furnished sparsely and none too fancily, despite its Victorian appointments, which included the original light fixtures and fine woodwork. The living room had a matching couch and love seat that were comfortably worn. A small, flat-screen TV adorned the wall between two built-in bookcases filled with paperback books. A handmade rug softened the hardwood floor. To the right, a door opened to an eat-in kitchen that had a 1950s-style table for two that had passed shabby and hid antique. On the wall next to the table was a large photo of a serious, young-looking man who looked a lot like Tad. The man was dressed in a suit, and standing next to a good-looking woman in a wedding dress with her brown hair in a poofy style common a couple of decades ago. Her smile lit up the room, even from a photograph. Mercy lingered, looking at the photograph.
"Come on, Mercy," said Tad, and she immediately complied.
"You've made your point," growled Adam, unable to hold back his anger, though Tad didn't deserve it. "That's enough."
Azeel hadn't spoken a word, just took everything in. He didn't protest when Adam hung back so that the other wolf was never behind them. Tad took them up the typically Victorian narrow and steep stairs to the second story and from there to a hallway. At the end of the hall was a half door, 2 feet wide by 3 feet tall, the kind of door that would have hidden a linen closet or a dumbwaiter. Since it was next to the bathroom, Adam would put his money on the linen closet. Tad put a hand on the door and closed his eyes. Mercy stirred, staring at the floor and moving closer to Adam, away from the wall. Adam could smell her unease, and he put his arm around her. Her feelings were clearly written on her face, too, and she'd never have shown fear to anyone if she could have helped it. She watched the walls as if something dangerous were crawling up from the floor beneath them.
"Whatever they did to her is more than just following orders," Adam said.
"Yes," agreed Tad, his hand still on the door. "I think it steals her will. That way she'd answer questions, follow orders, and not try to hide it when something scares her."
"It's okay, Mercy," he told her when she took another step back from him. "This is old magic, but it knows me, and it won't hurt anyone here and now." "Carefully worded for a fae who doesn't have to tell the truth," said Azeel.
Tad turned to the old wolf coolly.
"I am always careful with the truth. It is a powerful thing and deserves respect."
"Of course," answered Azeel. "When you are old, you will find yourself assuming that everyone else is careless with important things too. My comment was not meant as censure. You merely surprised me.
What do you see? Adam asked Mercy, who was looking at things he couldn't perceive.
Magic, she told him. Fey magic. Old magic. And it's crawling from the basement up to Tad's hand like a cat seeking a treat.
She looked at Tad, and for a moment Mercy looked more fey than he did.
It likes you, but it isn't very happy about us.
Tad smiled at her.
It'll behave itself.
The white milk glass knob on the door turned without help, and Adam liked that no better than he liked the description Mercy had given. Magic was outside his ability to sense unless it was very strong, and he did not like things that he could not perceive. When Tad pulled his hand off the door, it opened and revealed dark wooden stairs that were even narrower and steeper than the ones they'd just come up. They twisted as they rose, so they took up only the same amount of room as the narrow linen closet had, and Adam could only see four steps before they were out of view. Tad stepped in, and Adam heard the fabric of his shirt catch on a rough spot on the wood at the top of the doorway. Azeel followed, and Adam urged Mercy up as soon as the old wolf's feet disappeared from his sight. The passage was tight even for Mercy, and she banged a knee on a step, winced, and stopped climbing.
"Are you all right?"
he asked, his hand on her ankle.
"No," she said without heat. "Not really. That was the knee I heard in the car wreck. And there's a ghost."
"A ghost?"
He knew Mercy saw ghosts, but she usually didn't tell him when she saw them. She'd once explained to him that most ghosts were only sad memories. The ones that were closer to alive were often better off if they didn't know she could perceive them. He had a feeling that there was a story there, but he hadn't pressed.
"Hmm," Mercy said, "right in front of me. I think she's the same one that looks out of Z's dining room window sometimes."
Adam couldn't see anything except for Mercy's back because of the stupid spiral staircase, but he'd probably not be able to see a ghost even if they were in an open room.
"Can you get her to move?"
he asked.
"She's a repeater, I think," Mercy replied hesitantly.
A repeater, he'd learned from her, was a ghost that she could see, but who did not react to the real world at all, just did a certain action over and over again, usually in the same place and sometimes at the same time every day. More an impression than a remnant of a real person.
"What is she doing?"
"Crying."
Mercy's voice sharpened a little, making her sound more like herself. "That's what she does in the window, too. I wonder if she was that much of a wet blanket in real life." Peripherally, Adam had been aware of Tad and Azeel talking somewhere above them, but he'd been paying attention to Mercy, and so he didn't react quickly enough when Tad called out,
"Mercy, what's a holdup? Get up here!"
She scrambled up the stairs, heedless of the ghost. It was too late to do anything, so Adam hurried behind her. He saw nothing unusual, and didn't feel so much as a shiver. He emerged right on her heels to find Mercy tight-lipped and shaky.
"Mercy, are you okay?"
he asked, and she looked at him and solemnly shook her head.
"I was wrong. It wasn't a repeater."
She rubbed her hands and glanced behind him. "But she can't get in here."
"Who is she?"
asked Azeel.
"What does it mean that she wasn't a repeater?"
Adam didn't like the way Mercy looked. Too pale, and there was sweat on her forehead.
"It means that she tried to hitch a ride."
Mercy hugged herself and bounced on the balls of her feet.
"Who is she?" Azeel asked again. "Give us a minute," snarled Adam,
though he stopped himself from looking at Azeel and escalating matters further. The other wolf's chest rumbled warningly.
"Sorry," Adam said with an effort that cost him. "Mercy, is there anything I can do?"
She shook her head.
"No, I'm okay. I've just never had that happen before. She just clung to me, and I couldn't tell her to go away."
She shivered.
"But Z has this place barricaded with magic, and she couldn't follow me here."
She'd been in danger, and Adam had been right there and helpless. He had been leaving her alone because she didn't like cuddling in public much, and in this state, She had no choice. But when her teeth started chattering, he hugged her to him. She was icy cold and leaned into him. She was all muscle and bone, and she'd be offended if she knew he thought of her as fragile. Without the formidable will that drove her, she was small. Her teeth quit chattering almost right away. She looked over Adam's shoulder and said, "She's a ghost, Azeel. I've seen her a few times hanging out around this house."
"Our house is haunted?"
Tad sounded taken aback. "She doesn't bother you," Mercy said defensively. She stepped away, and Adam let her go. "I'd have told you about it if she were bothering you." Crisis apparently averted, Adam looked around. The room was narrow and long, wide enough, if barely, for three people to stand shoulder to shoulder. The floor was carpeted with layers of Persian rugs that were worth a not-so-small fortune. Unmatched bookcases lined the wall on one of the long ways of the room, ranging from hand-carved museum pieces to boards separated by cinder blocks. The top two shelves of each held a selection of unpainted metal toys. The rest of the shelves were filled with various sharp-bladed weapons. The books, and there were a lot of them, were piled on the floor on the other side of the room. The wall directly across from the doorway they'd entered was entirely covered by an enormous mirror.
"Could you shut the door, Mercy?" Tad asked, walking up to the mirror. "I don't activate the mirror without the door closed."
Adam got to the door before Mercy could, and closed the ghost out. He didn't like it that she was still obediently following orders, although this time, he thought, Tad hadn't meant it like that. Tad would know that giving Adam or Azeel orders under these circumstances might be a bad idea, and so he told Mercy. Mercy touched the door after Adam shut it. "There's some kind of magic," she said.
"Protections," Tad agreed without turning from the mirror. "Useful to keep out ghosts and spies."
He knocked three times on the mirror and said,
"Spiegel, Spiegle finde, fates Bild und Stimme, in der Tiefe deiner Sinne, seine Worte, seine Form, meine Worte, meine Form, Führerleiter, Führer zusammen, deine Wahrheit, Bindeglied, Verbinde unsere Wirklichkeiten, Wesen und Natur im Lied."
"Mirror, mirror on the wall," Azeel murmured when Tad quit speaking.
"Shh," said Tad. "This isn't that mirror. That mirror broke, and good riddance to it. Let's not give this one ideas, please."
Adam couldn't tell if he was serious or not. After a few minutes, during which the mirror did nothing more interesting than reflect everyone present back at it, Azeel started to look at the toys on the shelves, though he kept his hands to himself. It gave him an excuse to keep his back to Adam, which Adam appreciated. Mercy bent down to get a better look at the books. Most of them were German and old, but Adam noticed that there were a couple of newer mysteries, too, and what looked like a complete Doc Savage series, numbered 1 through 96, in paperback. Mercy reached out to touch one old book, and Adam's instincts made him block her hand.
"It's not smart to touch a grumpy old fae's things," he said.
"It wants me to touch it," she explained earnestly.
"All the more reason not to do it,"
Adam told her, keeping a hold on her hand. A compliant prisoner, he thought, has to do whatever she is told by who or whatever tells her to do something. He wondered if that ghost would have given her trouble if she had been able to exert her will. He glanced at the mirror, but there was still nothing more interesting than their reflections in it.
"Tad, what's the holdup?"
"Shh," the young man said. "Not so loud. Someone on the other side of the mirror might overhear. He'll come as soon as he can."
"There's a lot of metal in here for a phase, then," murmured Azeel. "And enough magic to make my nose itch."
"Z is a metalsmith," Mercy explained, leaning against Adam.
Like Azeel, she spoke quietly.
"Iron kissed. Zeebold Adalbert Smiter."
"The Doc Smith of Trondheim?"
Azeel was suddenly a lot more tense, his voice half strangled.
"That's right," said Tad, looking away from the mirror because Azeel was more interesting.
At least that was why Adam was looking at him.
Fortunately, the other wolf was looking at Tad.
Your father is Sloane MacLeavuin, the dark smith of Trondheim?
Azeel turned to Adam, averting his eyes at the last minute.
Are you sure you want to contact MacLeavuin? Do you know what he is?
He's mellowed with age, Mercy assured Azeel before Adam could say anything.